Miss Nesbit, reel 5.
But it was funny. I think they were too much alike in temperament. He didn't really ever get on very well with his mother. And they both had a great sense of humor, but never about each other.
Was he always able to show you his happy side?
Yes, I don't think I ever saw him. In his letters sometimes, I learned more from his letters about his affair with Kirkux and other things that had hurt him or upset him in his life. But when we were together, I don't remember either of us ever talking about, we would write to each other about our troubles, but we didn't ever talk to each other about.
Did you ever meet Catherine Cox?
No, never. I saw photographs of her in books after his death, but I never met her.
Did you ever meet the Olivier sisters that he knew in Cambridge?
No, never. I think he'd have had a very difficult life, because I'm quite sure, women would always have sort of fallen for him. There was something very irresistible about him. And I'm sure that if we'd been married, he'd have had lots and lots of affairs, and I'm sure he'd have suffered. It'd be all right if he'd had them, but he would have suffered attacks of conscience about it, because I realized that there was a girl called Irene Wellesley, I think, that he saw quite a bit of when I was in tour. We used to meet at parties here, because all the young soldiers Eddie would have up and produce. And I think he wrote to her quite a lot. But he used to write to me sometimes and says, I wonder if I've got any kind of moral sense at all. Are women like that? Do they fall for attractive young men? But I feel furious with an attractive young woman if she doesn't fall in love with me. I feel even more furious if she does. I could see it was always worrying him a little that he couldn't resist replying and being affectionate to someone who was...
How did that make you feel? Did it make you jealous
it
or
didn't,
worried?
Oddly enough, I think possibly if we'd been married it would have. But...
Or could you tell that she didn't mean very
I
much
I could tell in a way she didn't, because I could sort of look back to myself to times before he went to America even, when I knew I was in love with him, but if someone was making love to me, I wouldn't return it exactly, but I wouldn't. Would rather pass enjoy it in a quiet way, and I really felt he was the same, but being a man was more so. So I don't think I felt any jealousy. I probably should. Supposing we'd been married 5 or 10 years, then I probably would have felt a fierce jealousy, because I'd have got the sort of sense of possession about him, but I didn't. At that time, I just didn't have any possessive sense. I just have a bit sort of strange security that we'd never been without each other.
Well, I should think that's it, precisely. If you feel secure, then you wouldn't
then you
need to be
wouldn't
jealous.
Wouldn't need to be jealous, no, exactly.
After his death, and after you returned from America and so on, you did, in fact, marry.
Yes.
That must have been difficult in a way for your husband, if everyone associated you with Rupert Brooke.
I think it did, in a sense, because it was such a time afterwards. You see, it was Rupert died in 1915. I didn't marry till 1921. And so there was sort of a gap between. I think if I'd married possibly much earlier after his death, but I don't think. Because I remember my husband saying to me once, I went down to play Cleopatra and Auds, and he said someone, said the girl was coming down to play Cleopatra is the girl that Rupert Brooke was in love with. He said, that gave me a sort of interest in you, which I suppose it would at that time. He was at Oxford himself.
What do you think of what people have done with Rupert Brooke's memory? Some people practically worship him, and some people say, oh, he was just a sentimental boy,
yes.
You know, things like that.
Oh, well, that I think there is a sort of myth about him. I think it grows around the whole circumstances of his life and his death and his looks and everything. And I think that has affected people's feeling about his work very much. I remember Philip Toynbee, for instance, I remember reviewing something about him saying it was ridiculous. Sort of myth had grown up about him as being a great young war poet, and he wasn't even a minor poet, and he was just a neurasthenic young man like that. So some affects some people quite literally, and then other people. I think it's one of those things that very likely a time will come again when there'll be a revision of that feeling. People sort of flame up like a comet and die down. But I think he'll always remain. I was very surprised. Geoffrey Keane is his executor, and he was telling me the other day that anything from 1,500 to 2,000 books of his books, of poems, are still sold every year after that.
Well, that's extraordinary for poetry.
Quite extraordinary. But I know he is very much a poet of youth. I think very young people. I was always staggered in America the amount that he's read in high schools there, and I'd get letters. It was a terrible biography, sentimental, rubbishy biography. It was written by an American. It was called Red Wine of Youth, and it had several photographs of me in it at the time that he'd got from Eddie Marsh, I think, or something. A lot of completely untrue. But it had been read a lot in schools, and I would get letters from various towns I was playing in, get letters from schoolboys or schoolgirls asking if they could come and see me because they had to write their thesis, as they called it, about Rupert Brooke, and could I tell them something? And I remember there was a photograph in it, this book, which had underneath it Rupert Brooke's favourite portrait of Kathleen Nesbit, was found among his effects when he died and was sent back to England to Eddie Marsh. It was a photograph that was taken at least 6 years after his death. And I wrote to this man who said, would I autograph it from him? He sent me a copy of the book, and I said, I'd autograph with pleasure, but I may tell you, Rupert Brooke never saw this picture. And he wrote back quite indignant, says it, but it says on page 62 that it was found among his effects. It says so in print, so of course it must be true.
Oh dear. Do you find it rather tedious? Do you get tired of telling the same things over and over again about Rupert Brooke?
I do, really, in a way, because you see, when you get to my age, your memory gets very funny, or some people's does. Some people keep a brilliant memory to the end of time. But mine gets very foggy now, and I don't remember clearly things that are just a sort of mist that I would like to remember. And I think, oh, I can't go back and read that up and look it up. And then I just get a little bored sometimes.
What do you think of his official biography?
The one
Christopher
Fassel. It was very good on the whole. I rather liked it.
It's too bad he died before it came out, actually.
Yes, it is very sad.
He obviously did a great deal of work.
Yes,
on
but
it
he did a great deal of work.
Of
and
yes. And
but I liked the book very much. And as a matter of fact, I learnt a lot from it about the time before I'd known him, about his youth and about the Olivier girls and about German experiences. It's quite a lot that we'd never really talked about, and so I was very interested to read it.
Though in a way, that might not be fair for you to find out about Rupert Brooke from the biography rather than from him. It seems to me the biography makes rather a lot of Catherine Cox. I'm sure she
yes.
was important, but he...
Yes,
I don't know if he
deal.
Overdoes it, but he seems to make... rather a great deal of
that. Well, I think it was And I've often wondered why. I think it had a tremendous effect on him, because what he spoke to me about it, it gave him a terrible guilt complex, because he really, at Cambridge, I think a lot of much more attractive looking. I'd never seen her, but I think in her photograph she doesn't look terribly attractive. Heavy, sort of horse-faced type, and I, this friend, Frances Cornford, whom I knew afterwards, said, people were very surprised that he was so mad about her, but there was something in her that did appeal to him most tremendously. I don't know whether it was a maternal quality or what, but he was mad about her, and she really wasn't mad about him. And she finally accepted his affections and went off to Germany and lived with him for a time there. And then, to his horror, he found she didn't want to marry her. It was this kind of disease with him almost. He just had to have her. And then she was pregnant. And they really had a very unhappy time in which he felt there was nothing else. He had to marry her, and she knew he didn't particularly want to, but by this time she'd fallen in love with him, and the whole thing had turned another. And I think they both had a great deal of unhappiness at that time, and he still, all his life, even, and as I thought, was very interesting that he gave commissioned a little statue of Eric Gills, of Mother and Child, and he'd given one to Kerr Cox, and he gave me one. And I think that the only times he'd ever given anyone presents. And but in his, when he wrote to Eddie and said, I suppose Carr is as near to a widow as I've got. And I think it was the sense that the child miscarried might have been his son. I mean, he still felt that thing, although she was happily married to someone else. But it still made quite, so I suppose in that case, since he was neurotic, and that things went very, very deep with him. And some of the letters I got about it, I suddenly realized when he was in America and he started, I thought, I wonder if he'd ever recover from that. But he did. I mean, he was, I think, quite serene and happy, really, in his life. But it did, had made a tremendous wound in his.
Do you still have his sculpture?
Yes.
Because of the war, you weren't really able to know him long enough to...
I wasn't, no. It was... I'd
perhaps have his child.
I'd always wished... I don't know. In those days, the whole climate was different. You see, sort of having a child until you were married was... They're really quite horrifying, at least to me. I didn't think the thing one could do, really. And I always wished afterwards that I hadn't been, but I sort of expected him to come back, you know. And then I did, last time we met, he wrote the sonnet for me at we're in Yarmouth. And we were talking then about marriage, and then he said, well, my real leave will come at Christmas, and I think we should do it then. I said yes, and he said, it'd be awful for you if I, supposing you were pregnant and I was dead. And I said, well, perhaps you weren't dead, and then you'd come back and there'd be a child, and we'd discuss it then. And we really had made up our minds, you know, that it was ridiculous to go on like this, but it didn't occur to us to consummate it somehow, because... Well, I think with him, too, I'm sure that he could have persuaded me, but I think after the Kerr Cox affair, he was so determined that nothing now would do but marriage, and marriage was a very serious thing, wouldn't she? But that is one thing I do regret very much, that I didn't have a child by him. I like the children I have got very much.
Well, yes. there's a biography of Rupert Brooke by someone called Michael Hastings that it's more recent than...
Oh, it's mostly photographs,
mostly
isn't
photographs.
It? Yes, yes.
It takes about 10 minutes to read, because
yes,
it is mostly
photographs. Yes, I remember he brought it to me once, so a long time ago now. It's some little time ago. I've rather forgotten.
But
about
in
it.
That, he says, I don't think you ever talk to him very much, because he doesn't mention you
no.
very much, but he does say that despite what Rupert Brooke said about Carl Cox, he, Michael Hastings, the biographer, thinks that you were the closest that Brooke had to a widow, which,
yes.
in a way, you were, since you were engaged, perhaps.
Yes.
But you're not included in the acknowledgements to his biography, so Michael Hastings must have written it without talking to you.
Michael Hastings must have written it...
Without talking to you.
Yeah, oh, yes, he did. I think I was in America at the time, because I remember when I came back from America, he brought me a copy of it and said he wished he could have talked to me. And just as Christopher Hassel, I was in America at the time, he was writing his, and he used to write to me from time to time and say, oh, I do wish we could have a talk about it, because there are lots of things I would like to ask you, but I somehow can't put them down in black and white.
Which are your favourites of his poems? I suppose it probably depends on your mood, of course.
Oh, my mood, yes. I think there are one or two very good ones. One called Dining Room Tea, which I think is quite lovely, and the fish, I think,
yes.
is very good.
I know that Yeats got very sick of hearing the Lake Isle of Innisfree.
I know, yes.
I wonder if... No matter what you felt about Rupert Brooke, I wonder if you get sick of hearing some of his. You know, there are certain ones that one always hears.
Always hears. I think I got used to the sound of them, and I like it. For instance, I think the first of the war poems, the one that was quoted so much, I never liked very much, even when I first saw them in the on the postcard. But... some of the others I like. I have one called Clouds that I think is very beautiful.